You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 69 for September 30th, 2015. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we interview archaeologist and author Francis Pryor about his upcoming crowdsourced archaeological fiction book. Francis has been a fixture in British archaeology and has participated in many episodes of the popular British show Time Team. So, listen to this podcast, then go write your manuscript and send it on to Unbound, the publisher you're about to hear all about, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now.
Hello, everyone. Today, I am joined by Bill in Arizona.
Hello.
Chris, who is doing some field work in California.
Hey.
And our special guest, Francis Pryor.
Hi.
So, Francis is here to talk to us about his new book coming up. It is a crowdfunding book. So, something very new to archaeology, and it's a different sort of book. Francis, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Well, it's the second of a series of detective mysteries featuring an archaeologist who is working on excavations. This one takes place on a live televised excavation. And in the course of that dig, he uncovers and works on a murder. I'm not going to say if he was successful or not, because that would be giving it away.
And you're doing this through crowdfunding. You're publishing this book, correct?
That's correct, yes. I mean, I could have done it conventionally because I am I am an author and I do have publishers. But I decided to do it through crowdfunding because I wanted to get through to a slightly different audience. I wanted to reach a slightly younger audience. I wanted to reach an audience who weren't necessarily familiar with my, you know, more academic type books, my other archaeological books. In other words, I wanted to broaden the scope of my audience.
And the process, is it, so obviously you have the sort of end result and the crowdfunding and stuff like that, but in terms of the rest of it, so coming up with an idea, writing out your idea, taking it to an editor, copy editing, all that stuff, is it very different with, I believe your publisher is called Unbound for this book, is it very similar to what you've experienced with your other sort of publications, or is it something completely different?
That's very interesting you should ask that, because I mean, my other publishers are HarperCollins. I've done sort of half a dozen books with them, and Penguin. So, you know, big national publishers. And the editorial process is precisely the same. Unbound's editorial policy is very strict. You know, they don't accept rubbish. But in order to get the book funded, crowdfunded, it has to be accepted by Unbound, so you have to put in a proposal, a detailed proposal. You then have to argue your case, and they then have to accept it. And when I did my first book with them, which is called The Lifers Club, it's quite difficult to get it accepted. It's not easy. People think, oh, well, if you're going crowdfunding, you know, you can publish any old rubbish. You can't. You really, really can't. Because they don't want to put all the effort into raising the money, getting the subscribers, only for it to fail. So, you know, you've got to jump through a lot of hurdles, a lot of hoops before you actually get the book commissioned.
So, Francis, this is Chris real quick. I just want to be clear. Yeah. You're doing the crowdfunding through the publisher? It's a publisher that does crowdfunding?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
The publisher specializes in crowdfunding, yeah.
And what was the name of that publisher again? I want to make sure we get these links in the show notes.
Yeah. The publisher is called Unbound.
Okay.
Unbound.co.uk.
Okay. Do you know if they only service like UK manuscripts, or do they look internationally?
I think they look internationally.
Okay, cool. I'll definitely check into that.
Yeah, sure.
And could you tell us about the process you went through to get it? So did you have to sort of submit like a book description to Unbound, and then they sort of did a normal editor's thing, look through it, and then decide to put it up there? Is there like a interview process? How does one go about approaching Unbound to get a book published with them?
Right. Well, I think Unbound were the first of the crowdfunding publishers. And it was set up by three authors who wanted to get control of books back to the writers of books, because I think there is a common perception, I think there was some justification, that the publishing industry looks after itself. It doesn't look after its authors. And so that was their primary aim. And I knew one of the founders of Unbound. Unbound was founded about 3-4 years ago. And I knew one of the founders who I had worked with on some television programs in the past. And I had done a presentation at the Hay on Wye Book Festival on one of my books for Penguin. And when I was on the way to the bar after having done a presentation and signing, Justin Pollard, who was the co-founder of Unbound, hailed me and said, "Francis, what are you doing?" And he told me all about Unbound and gave me a card and talked to me. And I didn't tell him, and he didn't know, but at the time, I was writing this detective book. And about a year later, 9 months, a year later, I phoned him up and said, "Look, I've been writing this book." And he said, "Okay, do me a 7-page summary of what the book's all about."
Francis, because you've published previously with them, Lifers Club, I believe, is your previous
Lifers
book.
Club, yeah.
Yeah. And your newest ones, you're currently raising funds for it. Does Unbound, do they do nonfiction sort of work?
Oh, yes, they do. That's their main output is nonfiction. One of the people that they're particularly famous for writes books called Letters of Note. Trying to remember the Sean Usher. He's got a terribly popular website, he produces these extraordinary sort of facsimiles of people's letters and that sort of thing. I mean, there's a book that Unbound published by Mrs. Stephen Fry. And you can imagine who wrote that. They do have, very popular, very well-known writers. So it's not a publishing house for people who are not going to get their work published elsewhere. That's the main point.
And you've done some pretty seminal books in archaeology, so Britain BC, The Making of the British Landscape. I know those came out a while ago. If this had been available back when you were publishing those books, would you have gone with this option of crowdfunding those books?
No, I think not, because they had a sort of surefire market. And they were done in conjunction with television series and that sort of thing. They were tailor-made for the book trade as it was in the early 21st century. I still plan to publish some more books for people like Penguin if they'll have them. But it was specifically my venture into fiction, which I felt required a fresh approach, a fresh audience. And I think that's the great strength of crowdfunding, is that it allows you to change tracks, to move in new directions. And if I was thinking of launching a new archaeological series, say I was doing an excavation or something, and I wanted to produce reports that were going to go beyond the immediate audience of a particular excavation, which might well be a very local audience. If I wanted to do a bit more than that, then I would look quite seriously at crowdfunding.
So, Francis, what is the book about that you're getting crowdfunded right now, and when do you think it'll be out? how much can you say about that?
I can't say much because I mustn't give away the plot. But it's the follow-up to The Lifers Club.
Okay.
The Lifers Club was based on a true experience I had. I live in the Fens, and for our friends across the Atlantic, the Fens are the lowest-lying, flattest part of Britain. It's sort of a miniature Holland at about sea level. Mm-hmm. And it's a very flat, wet, windy landscape, which I love because I live here. But it's got a prison in the middle of the Fens at Whitemoor, which has some fairly hardened, nasty criminals in it. And a long, long time ago, I got invited by the lifers, prisoners at Whitemoor, to do some talks on the archaeology of the Fens. And when I actually got to meet them, far from being these sort of blood-curdling murderers, they turned out to be charming, very nice men. And I got on very well with them. And I did a couple of talks for the Lifers Club. And this eventually set me thinking about a book. And so that's how my first book arose. The second one, which I'm doing now, is based in the southern Fens around the cathedral city of Ely, in the Black Fens, the peat Fens. And there's all sorts of nasty goings on in the murky, dark peat. And it's sort of mixed up with the early Christian church and pilgrimages in the modern period and those other things. And the main thing is that the action actually takes place in an excavation. And the excavation is being televised live on national television. And we're not talking about sort of cable television, we're talking about national preview on air television. So there's probably an audience of, 5-10 million people looking at it. And I've got a lot of experience of doing that. And so I thought I'd put it to good use and write this murder mystery surrounding that.
Okay. Is there any, like, say, historical aspects to this, or is this 100% work of fiction?
No, there are historical aspects of it. I built some of it around a very, very early Anglo-Saxon saint called St. Fursey, who is Celtic saint, actually. He came from Ireland, and he ended his life in France, I think it is. There's quite a lot of genuine stuff in it, if you'll believe it.
Nice.
Francis,
yeah.
I've been an advocate of, so a little bit on me, I've done cultural resources in the United States for a few years now, and I have seen amazing sites get excavated and written up on, in really good technical journals, technical series about these great sites, but then I've watched them just kind of go into one of those Indiana Jones vaults where there's, you know, endless room of technical journals and no one ever looks at them again unless they're a PhD student, right? And so I've kind of been an advocate of making vernacular accounts so that people who live in the community can learn a little bit more about their the history and the archaeology of their area. Do you think that crowdfunded either nonfiction or fiction is a good way to get that out to the public?
I do, absolutely, yes. And I got a lot of sympathy for you, with you, because for 10 years I worked at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. So, I used to commute across the Atlantic because I was digging in England in the summer and going back to Toronto in the winter. And I spent a lot of my time in the States. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because archaeologists over there have managed to build up this terrific rapport with the local community. And yet the reports they write, at least I'm basing this on working a long time ago, were often, based on 5-foot squares in those days, but very, very heavy duty learned stuff. And, if you were a member of a local community, you must have been tearing your hair out. But nowadays, I think something like crowdfunding is absolutely the answer to your problems. If I know local communities in North America, there are going to be people there who would dip into their pockets good and deep to fund this sort of information. And that's basically all it is. It is just subscription. You have various levels. So, my books, the cheapest level, which is, I think, £5, is the ebook. Then for £20, you get the special hardback. For £50, you get the special hardback, which I am kind enough to sign. Then for £80, you can have a special trip around my garden when I open it in the summer. And for £100, you can do a special trip around one of my sites or a museum or something like that, which I will conduct. So, that gives you a range of things to do. And from my point of view, what I love about it is that I get to know my readers, through personal contact. And that's one of the things I really like about crowdfunding, which you don't get through one of the big publishing houses.
So the setup is very similar to other crowdfunding sort of projects in that there's different levels. And so at the very basic level, you get the book, but at different levels, there's going to be sort of, I hate this word when they describe it in crowdfunding, but rewards. I should say different levels of contribution and returns. Do you get to sort of have a discussion about what those are? And I think for one of your books, you did a tour of Stonehenge.
Seahenge.
Seahenge.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, I thought of that. When these different levels are set up, it's done very much in consultation. In fact, I have to, think of them. It's part of the author's job. It's part of setting up the whole project. And then, of course, there is the launch party, which people can come to, that's another level, quite an expensive level. Yes, that's very carefully thought out. Some people, and I personally don't do this, but some people say, if you pay a certain amount, then your name can be the name of a character in the book. I draw the line at that. As I said in a blog recently, in fact, I think it was in Doug's blog, names are part of the character and atmosphere of a book. And if you you know, you can't farm it out. I mean, the classic one is Sherlock Holmes. You know, if Sherlock Holmes had actually been sponsored and it, the sponsor's name was Joe Bloggs, it wouldn't have made Arthur Conan Doyle's name.
All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs.
Did aliens build Stonehenge? Did the Easter Island statues walk? Did the Vikings colonize Midwest America? What does mainstream archaeology have to say about all of this? Listen to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast and learn about popular archaeological mysteries. Hoax or fact? Learn to tell the difference with Dr. Kenneth Fader and co-host Sarah of the Archie Fantasies blog. Check out the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archie Fantasies and get ready to think critically. Let's get back to the show.
Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
How would you go about pitching one of these proposals? I mean, does it seem like your publisher is going after established writers like you, or, you know, is there a proposal process that things get thumbs up and thumbs down?
Yeah, there is a proposal process. And they don't just go after established writers. But one of the things that the Unbound people are looking for is an internet presence. So that when I went to them 3 years ago with my first book, with the Lifers Club, I could show that I had a blog with, 1,300 followers or whatever it was, that I had a fairly big presence in the television world because I was doing television work. And then they immediately set me up with a Twitter feed, which I didn't know anything about at the time. And before I knew it, I'd got 4,000 or 5,000 followers.
Wow.
You know, and so now, you know, I mean, I now begin to understand it. I've got lots of Facebook friends. I've got 7,000 followers on Twitter and so on. And so I've learnt to, rather late, but I've learnt to play that game, you know, to do the internet. But that's terribly important. You've got to have an internet presence if you possibly can. But having said that, if the idea is strong enough, the crowdfunder will help you do all of that because it's in their interest. They want good books.
Francis, a question about that sort of internet presence. I noticed that there's a Twitter account for Alan Cadbury. Am I pronouncing the character right?
How did you get hold of that on the other side of the puddle?
Yeah, so was that something you did, create a Twitter account? Well, I guess a real life sort of persona for your fictional character, or is that the publishers?
No, that wasn't the publishers. They didn't know anything about it, although they laughed quite a lot when it happened. That was something which, I don't want to spoil this, but a lot of people believe in Alan Cadbury. They think he's real.
Nice.
We all need something to believe in.
You've got to have something to believe in. But the main thing about it is that when he does his tweets, he isn't me. He's Alan Cadbury. He's got a separate geographical identity. So, that was a bit of fun, which a close friend of mine and I came up with, yeah. But don't tell anyone else, for heaven's sake.
Nice. Francis, I wanted to ask you real quick. This is Chris again. So you've published books through, like you said, through traditional publishing methods, you know, with regular publishers. Are the contracts any different? I know as a first-time author, I published a book a year ago, and I mean, I don't know. It's a small publisher. You know, they kind of just do like archaeology things and stuff like that here in the United States. And I got 8% for each book. I don't know if that seems pretty standard for their contracts, but is it similar for the for going with Unbound because it's a different format or is it different?
That's a very good question. And normally speaking, I wouldn't dream of answering it in a straightforward way.
Right. No numbers or anything. I just want to know if they're similar.
No, of course not. No. I mean, one of the points of doing crowdfunding is that you put a lot more work into it as an author into the marketing of your book. And one of the reasons you do that is that your return on the book is concomitantly higher because you're not paying for marketing people, you're not paying for all of that expertise. So when I'm with a big publisher, my return is roughly, I don't know, it depends on whether it's cut price editions or whatever, but normally the author's return is between, as you were saying, between 8% and 10%. Mm-hmm. But with Unbound, it's half.
Oh, wow.
You get 50%. Wow. And that is fairly standard. But on the other hand, your sales are a lot lower.
Right.
So, you know, if I sell a book through Penguin, I'm going to sell, well, I mean, my Making the British Landscape sold 10,000 in hardback, you know, before it moved into paperback when it sold, you know, many, many times that. And, you know, so you get a bigger return, but you put a hell of a lot more effort into it. So to be honest, the amount of money I've made out of the Lifers Club is a good deal less than I would have made had I done it through conventional publishers in the normal way. But, you know, that's not the reason you do it.
Of course not. Yeah. But interesting nonetheless.
Yeah. I mean, and that's despite the big proportion one's getting of the money.
Well, to me, it seems like a good middle ground between, say, traditional publishing and ebook publishing, where ebook publishing, you're typically doing everything, like 100% of the work yourself. With that, you might hire an editor or you might hire somebody for a graphic design or something like that, but chances are,
sure,
you know, you're doing everything, and then you're also getting 100%, or, you know, minus whatever Amazon or whoever you're putting it on is going to take, but, you know, you're getting a higher percentage. And it's nice going through somebody like Unbound, where you can actually, you know, it's a publisher, you can get a book, you can get an ebook, and you also get that slightly higher return, which is, it seems like a good middle ground.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is good middle ground. I certainly don't feel that I'm taking them for a ride, and I certainly don't feel that they are exploiting me. I think it's, you know, it's a fair return for the effort I'm putting into it. But the thing that I love about the crowdfunding is that you're part of a team. You know, I mean, I know a lot of the other authors now with Unbound. You know, how else would I have met, I don't know, a poet? You know, I mean, people like that, which are completely outside my normal realm of experience. I've met lots of really interesting, really nice people through Unbound. It is a family in a strange way. And it's that side of things which I find so refreshing, so exciting, and such fun. You know, I mean, you know, what you know, parties and things at Christmas and whatever, which are genuinely relaxed, because we're all helping each other. I mean, I don't know how many of my co-authors at Unbound, their books I've subscribed to, but it must be, I don't know, at least a dozen. And I wouldn't have done that normally, but, you know, it's part of the process.
Nice. That's good to know. It's nice to hear that there is a, they are helping to create a wider community, and it's not just an author working with an editor or something like that. And, you know, and you're kind of working in that vacuum. You're working with everybody else, so you get to meet everybody else and see the different types of work they do. I like that.
Yes, Mia. Yeah, I do too.
And with this whole 50%, it seems like it puts you a lot closer also with the people, your readers as well. So when people are, you know, donating to, well, or purchasing one of the different levels at Unbound, it's not just that it's going to a traditional publisher. It's they're really sort of having that connection with you as an author and supporting you a lot as well. Do you find that?
Yes. No, I mean, that's one of the things which, to be honest, I like about it. You know, with people are putting, if you like, their money where their mouth is. And it creates a very strong link, because in essence, what they're doing when they're funding you, they're not putting money in your pocket. Well, they are, of course they are. But what they're doing is that they're paying for you to write the book. It's your time. So when Unbound was set up, the idea of the whole thing was that enough money would be raised during the subscription process to pay the author to write the book. Now, in my case, I wrote the book first in my first case, The Lifers Club. So in effect, it was paying me in arrears. In the second book, I've written most of it, but I'm currently having second thoughts about large parts of it. So I'm going to have to do a certain amount of reworking. And all of that is going to be paid for by Unbound, you know, by my advance when the thing's paid for. But the third book of the series, which I've got very much in my head now, I've decided I'm going to write in the way that Unbound intended their subscriptions to be used, as an advance to pay the author to live while he or she is actually writing the book. And that is the key thing. It's a way of generating an advance on a good idea.
I did not realize it was meant to be sort of an advance. I kind of, looking around the website, thought it was something where you had a book, you had it mainly done, and then this was the sort of final push. But it's actually so it's meant to be sort of reverse. You raise the funds with an idea and then use that funds to support you while you write up that idea, correct?
That's correct, yes. That was the idea of the three authors who set the company up. I had a long discussion with Justin Pollard, who was one of them. And that was their idea. And in some cases, that is actually what happens. You have to write the first chapter to give a flavor of what the book's going to be all about. But you don't have to write the rest of the book. You write the first chapter, which could be as long as you want. So, you know, let's say you produce 5,000 words for the first chapter, and then you produce an outline of the book, and that is what you use to sell the book to raise the fund. And then, you see, if you're then writing it while the subscription process is taking place, that also helps, because you can then do blogs and that sort of thing, which will bring in more subscribers. So that's another way of doing it. Or you could get the whole thing funded and then start writing. The two ways of doing it. I personally, next time round, am going to be writing while the funding process is taking place. With any luck, I'll get the funding sort of halfway through my writing, and then I'll do the last bit on a fully funded book.
So for some of our listeners who might be interested in going through this sort of process, what is sort of, I don't even know if there is a set time scale, but is there sort of if you produce the first chapter and you have the outline, are people sort of expecting you to deliver the book within a year, 2 years? Is there sort of a timeline at all to that?
Yeah, there's a very approximate timeline. I mean, I forget what it was on my contract. but I think the timeline is, I think it's a year, but it's very flexible because it depends how long the fundraising takes. I mean, the fundraising for my Lifers Club book took 6 months. My second book has taken a little bit longer. That's partly because the whole Unbound thing has become bigger and more diffuse. And then I would imagine the third one will take, roughly speaking, the same time. There are deadlines, there are timescales, because if you think of it from Unbound's point of view, if your project isn't going to work, you know, if the boat isn't going to float, they've got to have the chance to say, no, I don't think this is going to work. Although actually, in the real world, they do that very, very rarely. I can only think of maybe one or two examples where that's happened. You know, basically, they want the projects to work because the people who set up the company are all authors, and they know what, you know, what hell that would be if your project did nosedive.
So I'm wondering, Francis, this is Chris again, what, just to kind of drill down into this because I'm so curious about it, what exactly does Unbound provide as their service? They clearly provide like the crowdfunding platform, but then when it comes to like editing and cover design and layout and things like that, do they do all that too, like a real publisher would?
Yes, they do. They're very good. In fact, their standards of production are, to be honest, higher than most regular publishers. They really are. I mean, the first book I did with them, The Lifers Club, you know, the actual production of the book, you know, they used the proper sort of 18th century typeface, which had been updated. It was a beautiful hardback production. Had a marker rhythm in it, you know, which is something I haven't seen in the book for years. And then, of course, on the sort of final 10 pages are the list of all the subscribers. So they do a very, very high quality production. The letters of note for Sean Usher books, which are these facsimiles of letters from, I don't know, Elvis Presley and God knows who, out of beautiful, beautiful productions. I mean, and they take a real pride in that. And the editors, my agent, who, you know, he's one of the best agents in the business, you know, he's Hilary Mantel's agent. He really knows his job inside out. He told me that the actual copy editing and story editing, because I kept him in on the whole process of my first book, he said was, you know, as good as anything you'll get in the conventional publishing world. So I think the actual standards of production are as high, if not higher, than in the publishing world in general.
Nice. That sounds good.
Yeah, I'm very impressed.
I got that whole different type font, that sounds amazing to me. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you can do with a, you know, an e-publication that's more difficult to do with paper. You know, and right away I thought of something like having the 19th century typeface for, you know, if you were describing the life of the 19th century people, and then, you know, a 1980s or a 1950s typeface for the archaeologist who's in the present, you know, excavating. That was just the first thing that I thought of.
The Archaeology and Ale podcast presents a monthly series of lectures on all aspects of archaeology. These lectures are part of the Archaeology in the City program, hosted by the University of Sheffield in England, and are held at the Red Deer Pub near the end of the month. The podcast can be heard a few days later. Check out the Red Deer if you're in the area, or find this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the show.
I'm really interested and curious about your writing process. So, you know, writing technical archaeology reports and being, like you said, one of those stodgy Americans that writes that really dry stuff. How do you how do you remake yourself as a fiction writer?
I think the answer to that is that it's a hell of a lot easier to write the technical stuff than it is to write the non-technical stuff. You know, having written, I don't know, a couple of dozen heavy-duty monographs of excavations I've done over the years, they are a lot easier to write because you can fall back on the jargon, you know, and you don't need to use punctuation if you're using writing academic English. You know, it's a very easy form of writing. And then when I started writing my popular books, sort of, you know, back in the late 1990s, I realized how very difficult it was. And I had a professional London agent, and I would send my early drafts of my books to him, and he would just send them back covered in red crayon, you know. And I learned how to discipline myself, because it requires more discipline to write popular stuff, not less, far more. You have to be much more precise, but you also have to be more intimate. You have to be more friendly. And, you know, it's been an extension of that process of learning how to express yourself in a comprehensible, popular way, to such an extent now that I don't think I could do any academic writing because, well, no, I really don't, because, you know, I use punctuation. I express myself clearly. And if you write academic stuff, you can't do that. You know, it doesn't go down well with the assessment boards and the, you know, all these other brain dead people who look over your shoulder.
Nice.
It seems like you already had a writing system, though. Like you already were trained yourself to sit down and write, you know.
Yeah.
So you just had to learn how to write in a vernacular form more than in the more academic form, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I did. It's just a different discipline, but it's a harder one. You know, when I was writing big excavation monographs and things, you know, I could easily knock out 5,000 words a day. You know, it wouldn't cause me any problem at all. Now, when I'm writing fiction, if I do 1,000 words a day, I'm very happy with myself.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Ian Rankin does 6,000 words a day when he's writing his detective fiction, but he's in a different class than me.
You know, yeah. Francis, I had a question about the. I was just looking on the website at the page for the book and the crowdfunding effort. It says you're 81% funded, which is nice. It's getting close.
Yeah.
I don't see, like, on other funding similar websites, there's usually a time limit. I don't see a time limit on here. Do they just let it go until you get 100%, or will they cut it off at some point if you never reach that for some reason?
Yeah, no, they don't do that. It's not part of the Unbound culture. You know, I've got a time limit in my contract, which I think I'm coming up to, but they're not going to push it. They reckon that once you get to 50%, the book's going to go anyway.
Yeah, 81% is pretty high. I imagine they've got a healthy sum of money for that.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
And for our listeners, we'll have a link in the show notes. The book is The Way, the Truth, and the Dead. So if you are interested in buying it, you can go to the site. We'll have the link there, and you'll be able to contribute to the crowdfunding.
No, I think that the phrase you're looking for, Doug, is spend money like water.
I think you found the right guys then.
Yeah, we had an author on about a year ago that said to go out and buy his book and then burn it and buy another one, if you wouldn't mind.
You know, hey, I'm sold on this. This is this seems like it's the way it should be as far as archaeology writing. If there's, you know, one tip that you could give an aspiring person like us to making the transition towards this, what advice do you have?
I think it's very simple, and it is tell stories. If you want to retain your reader's attention, you've got to have a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think one of the problems with archaeological writing is that it's descriptive, that people think you can describe something and that will retain people's attention. It won't. You can only retain people's attention if you're telling a story.
That's good.
And I think that's absolutely the key thing. That's all you need to know.
That's basically the one thing we don't do.
Exactly.
Nice. Putting the gray in gray literature out here.
One sort of final question. I've known quite a few archaeologists I've worked with who've done a lot of fiction, but more, not actually as contemporary, like their main characters haven't ended up being archaeologists, but they'll do fiction on, you know, past cultures, stuff they've actually dug, but, you know, 2,000 years ago. Have you run into other archaeologists who are working on sort of fiction work? I know I've met quite a few, but it doesn't seem like there's a community or a place where people sort of meet up to, you know, archaeologists meet up to talk about their fiction writing. Have you run into other archaeologists doing this? Have people approached you and said, oh, by the way, I do fiction as well?
That's very interesting. No, not as an archaeologist, I haven't. I've met quite a few people subsequently, you know, since I've started writing popular stuff, who have some archaeological experience. But no, I haven't met an archaeologist as such who writes fiction. The only one I ever did know was my professor at Cambridge back in the 1960s, Glyn Daniel, who wrote The Cambridge Murders, which he set in a college between two medieval colleges in Cambridge, a non-existent college because there was no space between these two colleges. And in my second book, one of the people in the book is actually a fellow at this college of infinite thinness, we revisit the college that Glyn Daniel wrote about in the 1950s, so there's a little bit of sort of fun in that, you know, for connoisseurs of obscure archaeological fiction. But to answer your question, no, I don't know of other people who are writing, fictional archaeology. And I wish I did. I mean, if you could set it up, Doug, there would be it would be great to have a blog presence or something. Maybe at the next Institute of Field Archaeology conference or theoretical archaeology group or something like that. There could be an organization, a seminar for archaeological fiction writers. It would be a very good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the blogs I follow, she's an archaeologist, but she writes fiction. And so I actually follow her fiction blog, which is quite interesting. I've met quite a few other ones. So, yeah,
oh, really?
It would be interesting to set up some sort of community of archaeologists who write fiction.
That's a really good idea. It really is a good idea, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be great. I mean, the podcast is going to be heard by a lot of people, but it'd be even better to have a more prolonged platform for, you know, people who want to write fiction that are archaeologists, or even people who write fiction that need more information about archaeology, where they can go and learn more.
But yeah, I think that's a good idea. I mean, one of the reasons I got into writing my detective stories is that I was at a railway station, and I went into the bookshop, and there was a book which was set on the North Norfolk coast, a detective story. And so I bought it and read it. And I thought it was a cracking good read because, you know, my archaeological work is on the North Norfolk coast. So that's where Sea Henge was and so on. And when I got to the acknowledgements, it said, this book is based largely on the work published by Francis Pryor in his book Sea Henge, to which I am extremely grateful. I thought, bloody hell.
Nice.
So that sort of set me thinking. I subsequently met the lady in question, and she's a very nice person. But so actually, her detective, who is also an archaeologist, makes a guest appearance in the Lifers Club. She's the archaeologist who excavates one of the murders there.
Nice. So, Francis, I've got one last question before my internet connection gives out. Do you need to read The Lifers Club before you read The Way, the Truth, and the Dead, or do they stand on their own? Is it a true sequel, or are they just similar characters?
It is a true sequel, and okay. You don't need to have read the first before you read the second.
Okay, so the hardback I just ordered of The Way, the Truth, and the Dead, I can read that when it comes out?
You can, yeah.
Nice.
But if
nice.
You ask me nicely, I'll sign it for you.
Nice. Well, I'm in Nevada, so we'll have to work that out. All right, awesome. I think that's good. Oh, I did have another question. The Lifers Club. So I see that being promoted on Unbound here, but is that available anywhere else, or do you have to buy it through them, or do they distribute to anywhere else?
Well, in Britain, they distribute to bookshops, but okay. It's probably best to buy through them because that way I get my decent cut.
Well, yeah, there you go. Okay, good to know. I hear you there.
If you do it to Amazon, I get bugger all, to use a technical term.
Oh, I'm aware of the bugger all you get from Amazon. Don't worry. I think Bill is too.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, because both Bill and Chris, you guys' books have been on Amazon, have they not? Mm.
Yeah, and you know, mine actually isn't an ebook or anything. It's a hardcover. Well, it's a softcover book, but it's a real book, and you know, I get such a higher percentage, as low as it is, when you buy straight from the publisher, of course, versus Amazon. Mm. With Amazon, it's way lower because you get the same percentage, but you get it from the price Amazon sells it at. So, you know, the cut's lower because it's cheaper there. But, you know, it is what it is. Like you said, you don't do this for the money, right?
No. But yeah. It helps.
It does help. Helps bring that next one out.
Yeah, mine are both on Amazon, so I'm pretty familiar.
Yeah,
you know, with the royalties and the way that works. Mine aren't in bookstores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Mine's in bookstores. It's at conferences, but I don't know if it's in bookstores.
Isn't conference another word for bookstore for archaeologists?
Yeah, for us it is, yeah.
And that was Francis talking about his new book, The Way, the Truth, and the Dead. You guys can check it out on Unbound. Go buy a copy. Or, as Chris was saying, buy a copy, burn it, and buy another copy.
Nice.
So if you have any questions, Francis is on Twitter, and he also responds to comments on the Unbound page of his new book. So hopefully we'll see you guys out in the field, and hopefully you'll be reading this book when we see you.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website
website, or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRMArcPodcast, or you can tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. Thanks, everyone, for joining me this week. Thanks to Doug for hosting, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in. We'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye now.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
The one thing I really regret about North America is that I can't get Coors beer anymore.
Wow, I'm not sure if that's a regret.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.